Let's talk about Daphnis and Chloe, if we may. About 30 years ago, you made an iconic recording of this piece.
Well, you see, when Decca came to Montreal, they wanted to re-record my repertoire, but in digital technology.
It's the early digital technology, right?
Yeah. So we chose a piece which would, in fact, show to the people the incredible possibilities of the digital sound and what a compact disc is all about. And so that was a perfect piece in the sense that it's so colorful, it has a chorus and everything. And, well, it was the number 4 CD on the shelf, you know, in the history, you see. After Karajan, Shorty and Pavarotti, you know. So we had some success because it became a demonstration recording for the new technology. So everyone knew about this record.
But it has a specific acoustic that's related to where it was recorded.
Well, the engineers of Decca London came, and of course they have been always very fussy about the quality of sound, which has been the trademark of the recording company. They went around Montreal, I mean, for maybe 2 weeks.
What was wrong with the hall?
Well, the hall was not good. It was dry. No, it was not good. Obviously, it was dismissed immediately. You know. And so they found, after 2 weeks, a church which is about 30 kilometers out of Montreal in a small little village. And they came in and they say, it's here. So they took the benches and the whole thing out. And it was an empty space, put the orchestra in the center, and do ding, 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 and we made the record in one day, and that's it.
And did you know it when you went in there, that it had the correct possibilities?
No, I didn't know myself, but I trusted the engineers because, you know, they are really good, those guys. But it was very hard for us because we were not used to playing in a resonant environment, you know, because the hall there was so unbelievably dry and uninteresting, you know. Of course, it was a discovery. And what was interesting, it was difficult to play together.
I was going to say, how did that change what you were doing?
Oh, we were very nervous. I mean, we thought it was a catastrophe when we left the sessions, you know. I thought, oh, my God, this is absolutely terrible at the end, you know. And, you know, strangely enough, because when you're under pressure, you don't judge properly either. So when a couple of weeks later I went to London and I heard that and I was very surprised. Of course, we did a few little adjustments, but not many because...
You can't do many anyway with that kind of reverb. You'll get caught if you start to play with it.
Yeah, and we didn't have the material because, you see, we were making one record a day. So it was usually... two versions with the orchestra was not very good at correcting things. You know, some orchestras, like in London, you say, okay, guys, 7 bars before A, let's do that. Bang! They take the patch and they put it there. The Montreal never worked well. We always did
the whole thing.
The whole thing. I mean, a full movement or at least half. You know. So that's it. So we have made close to 100 records there, and I had worked with other orchestras also, and I personally have made about 200 with 7 or 8 companies, you know, long before coming to Montreal, you know, from 1970, actually, I started. But now the recording business is disappearing very quickly, and it's not the same thing, you know. It's not the glamorous thing which existed in 30 years ago. To make a recording was a consecration of something. Today, you know, everyone makes a recording at home. You know, you put the microphone,
laptop, yeah.
You have this, a laptop, and so it's finished, you know.
Do you feel privileged to have lived through that time as a recording artist?
Yes, oh, of course. I think I've lived through a golden period because I was at the very beginning of the compact technology, the CDs, you know. And we have recorded what we had to do. And after that, the market went down. And now it's dead, more or less.
But those records are still there. Those recordings are still there. And,
yes.
And if you were starting out today, if you were a composer of 35 years of age now, there's no possibility that you would be looking ahead to doing the amount of recording that you did.
No.
It's never. We're not going to have it again.
No, it won't. I don't think so. But I mean, you never know. It may rebound or something. But the world has changed so much. You see, my dear friend, it's just unbelievable. Every day I discover that in every field, you know, that it has changed so much. The values have changed so much. The culture as such does not exist in the way it used to be. And now it's information. You know, people are well informed. Kids are informed. They know a lot of everything, but it stays here. You know, it's not digested. It doesn't go far. So,
are you just an old man now, then?
No, I'm not old, but I Yes, I'm old, but I'm not old in terms of because I have. It's not a nostalgia. It's just more a criticism of what I see, and I'm not saying that. Before was better and so on, but today is certainly not good.
Yeah, it probably was. Let's not be
so put it the way you want, you know?
Let me ask you about, because we're talking about communication, and famously you're a good communicator. You're a good communicator. You know how to talk to people.
Yeah, sometimes,
often. Yeah. Yeah. You have a reputation for being very charismatic, both in public, in private, and with musicians. Oh. You also have a reputation with musicians for making them work. That if it's not right, we'll do it again. And if it's not right, we do it again. And was that the case with every orchestra? And was that the case here with this orchestra?
Well, you know, when you rehearse, there are different ways of rehearsing. The rehearsal technique is the result of several decades of experience. It's not enough to say to an orchestra, okay, let's do it again because we are not together. Okay, they will do it, but it's nothing will change or much. Maybe it'll be together, but it's not a artistic way to, you know, to talk about music and things. On the other hand, if there is some problem, a big problem, I first of all say, here is the problem, but I don't try to solve it. I want the musicians to make the effort to do it, and if the problem stays, then. It's like a doctor. You have to have a diagnosis, and then you have to say, do this, 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 and then you cure the problem. And this is where the experience comes in.
So have you always done it like that? No.
Oh, no. When I was 30 years old, I was not capable of... I mean, I always rehearsed well, you know, but I was not capable of having enough knowledge to talk to a bassoon player or the first horn of a great orchestra and tell him to do this and that and this and that. And they looked at me and say, who? But today, of course, they respect that because they know that, I hate to say they know that I'm right, but they know that I know.
And you've earned it.
You know, you see, if you compare a conductor to a good doctor, I think it's important. It's really, you have to make the right diagnosis of what the problem is when there is a mistake or something, intonation, balance, how to produce these things. You know, I give some classes here and there because sometimes I think all these decades and things that I've been working and I have worked with about 150 different orchestras, you see, and the quality of the orchestra doesn't make any difference. If there is a problem, no. But I mean, of course, you don't learn much with a great orchestra. You learn with a second-rate or third-rate orchestra because you have to find a way to make them solve the problem. You see, of course, some people in the Philadelphia Orchestra, I don't have to tell them what to do because they know. But that's why you have to work with a second-rate orchestra for many, many years before. So this is where you learn your job, not with a great orchestra. Yeah. But I have done some classes, you know, they call that master classes, or whatever classes, you know, in Buenos Aires, in Tokyo, in China, in Korea, and so on. And I have all these kids coming in, you know, unbelievable to see the difference between this one and that one. For instance, Dudamel Gustavo, you know, this great guy, you know, he came to these classes because he was learning the Symphonie Fantastique. So he came to Buenos Aires, and you know, when I said, okay, you come in, you know, I didn't know him. when I saw that, I said, okay, go home.
You could see he was not good.
I didn't have much to tell him. Wow. You know, he was so unbelievably gifted. He would pick up all the things. But he wanted to hear the rehearsals and see these things. So he's a nice chap.
And he was in his early 20s at this point.
Oh, yeah. That was in 2001.
Right.
So that's 11 years ago. So he was 18 or something. Yeah.
What's your future with the Philadelphia Orchestra? You're saying that this is the end of your tenure, but you're not disappearing off this earth.
I have to take a break, you know, because there are many reasons for that. First of all, my calendar is very full. Secondly, you know, I need to go away for a while. You know, I've been involved in these 4 years. It was a bit of a trauma, you know. I want to do something else for a while. And Seguin, there's a Seguin coming. He also has to fly with his own wings. I don't want to be around and so on.
Have you talked to him?
No. You know, frankly, I don't know him. It sounds very funny because he comes from Montreal. And I met him in a park when he was 10 years old. He came with his mother. He came to ask for a signature on a program. It was a piece of paper. And he said, his mother said, you know, my son wants to become a conductor. That was very cute.
What did you say? Do you remember?
Well, I don't remember what I wrote on this paper, but so probably something encouraging. And then I met him once in the lobby of Montreal, you know, we were rehearsing, and about 30 seconds, 45 seconds, and that's it. I've never seen him at all. So I mean, 25 years in Montreal, he never came to my rehearsals, but he came to the concerts, I was told, but he never came to see me.
If you were to spend 2 minutes with him, what's the best piece of advice you could give him about what he's about to take on? Because he's not been in charge of a big, so-called big orchestra. He's been in Rotterdam. He's been in the Metropolitan Orchestra.
But you see, European management is different.
Okay, but so what does he need to do here? What would you do if you were him?
Well, I think depending on the questions, I would answer his questions. I'm not going to father him and... I think, obviously, one thing Yannick Nézet-Séguin has is a very nice way of working with people. I mean, I was told, and the musicians like that, you know, youthful, relaxed manner, not the kind of maestro, you know. So it's a different time, you see. Now, things have changed also in this profession. Orchestras are different than they used to be. And the responsibility of a music director has changed probably also.
Very different.
Yeah.
It's not so much that you're the boss. It's part of a collaboration now. Is that the way you think it is?
Yes. I'm the boss. You know, there is a moment. It's not the question of imposing your views, but it's the presence. Someone is there and you respect his authority. But you need also some leadership. Experience, you know, to tell people how to do it. And after all, the image of an institution depends a lot on the person who is conducting there. You know, I mean, it used to be even more before. Imagine these orchestras were made by one conductor, sometimes two. You know, it was a combination of, I would say, osmosis between a man, an orchestra, and a concert hall.
Everything you hear on WRTI is made possible by members. Please join today.